Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Good morning. This is Tracy Hales Bass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington, New Mexico. Today I'm talking with David Gessner about his latest book, Quiet Desperation, Savage Delight. Sheltering with Thoreau in the Age of Crisis. Hi, David.
Hi, Tracy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for talking with us and for writing Quiet Desperation and Savage Delight.
Well, it was my pleasure to write it. It's kind of how I survived COVID, so
yeah.
It was my therapy in a way.
Right. So. Well, before we go further, why don't we tell the listeners what it's about?
Well, about, okay.
Yeah,
I think the book starts with my saying that my daughter's 18 now, but when she was one, we took her to Walden Pond, and I had her riding up on my shoulders, and I said to her, "That's where the man lived who ruined your father's life," pointing to Thoreau's cabin. And as I say, the book ruined in a good way, mostly. Got me thinking about being a writer, got me thinking about going against the easy way to do things, made me poor for about 20 years as I struggled to publish my first book. But overall, certainly deepened my life. I can't say I read every word of Walden when I was 16 or 17 and first read it, but it got into me as a contagion, to use our current language. So I decided when the real contagion hit in about a year and a half ago, that I already had kind of gotten a head start on sheltering in place because I'd rebuilt a writing shack behind my house on the creek in North Carolina that had been destroyed in Hurricane Florence in 2018. I'd also built an Osprey platform out in the marsh and a dock, and so it was like I was readying myself, or as I say in the book, I was preparing for a test or cheating on a test I didn't know I'd have to take. So when we were suddenly all at home, I decided to turn back to the original shelterer in place, Henry David Thoreau, looked back to Walden, and kind of started to ask, what lessons can I take? Which will I reject? How can I really integrate them into my life? And some were pretty straightforward. The most obvious early on was learning our backyards, because Thoreau is the real prose column. I don't quite go that far. said, I have traveled a good deal in Concord. And he basically was saying, I've gotten to know this place right here, in my hometown. And by know, he meant know intimately, know the phenology of the place, which is the phenomenon of the year as things leaf and bud and birds come back and the whole miraculous turn of the year. And so that's the first thing I did, is kind of focus on my backyard, which lucky for me is attached to the Atlantic Ocean by Hewlett's Creek on a salt marsh. And Hewlett's Creek is more commonly known to most people as Dawson's Creek, because that's where they filmed the TV show.
Right.
And I can paddle out there on my kayak out to Masonboro Island, which is an unbuilt up, uninhabited barrier island. So I did have access to things that a lot of people probably didn't. And I really turned to nature during those first months. And then I also was in touch with a lot of scientists who were telling me what the big science experiment was like going on out there, like where suddenly people who'd lived in their shadow could suddenly see the Himalayas because
right.
The air was clear. amazing, right?
Amazing,
and
yes.
One that hit home for me, I lived in Boulder, Colorado for 7 years, so seeing the video of the mountain lion strolling down downtown Boulder through a snowstorm was pretty amazing.
Right.
And there was this kind of excited sense early on, which I don't think ultimately panned out, unfortunately, that we could kind of rewild the world if we took a break from all our flying and driving and endless charging about. And so that's kind of how it started. And then it was just strange. It's one of those things that writers find out is sometimes when you're working on a project, it's like you anticipate the world or you predict the way things are going to be. And as it turned out, I started turning toward Thoreau, kind of the activist who Martin Luther King and Gandhi both, you know, pointed to as being an important influence on them, just as our world started to kind of turn that way.
Right.
And the Black Lives Matter protests occurred, and my daughter and I went down to the protest downtown, and I was thinking about how strange it was that a man famous for being a loner and going away from the world brought back these ideas that I quote Martin Luther King quite a lot in the book about how a lot of his nonviolent philosophy grew out of, or reading Thoreau was incredibly inspirational for him. So it was kind of this funny mix. And then, of course, the whole year was that in a lot of ways. We were so inward turned, yet it was an election year that split the country.
Right.
And so it was kind of this pulsing back and forth. Each chapter takes on a different aspect of Thoreau and also moves in time through the year. So we start, I believe, in March. And that's another aspect from a literary point of view of the book, is I was trying an experiment in writing where I was really writing on the heels of experience. I had agreed with Torrey House Press, who did a wonderful job on the book. They're based in Utah. I made an agreement with them that if I got them the book fast, they would get the book out fast. So basically the book came out a year and a couple months after the pandemic hit the United States. And so it was this experiment in kind of writing and finishing these chapters and then moving in my life and on the page to the next chapter. And to me, that was really kind of an exciting and, as I mentioned to you, a kind of therapy for my own way of dealing with the pandemic. So that's like kind of an overview, but there were lots of course, my one trip that I really took when we were all kind of hunkered down at home was up to Walden Pond.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a pilgrimage. I actually, in flashback, I go out to northern Montana to Rick Bass's house where he's fighting for grizzly bears. You know, so it's a little episodic in that sense that each chapter takes on a different thing, but I think the whole coheres around the idea of what we can learn from Henry David Thoreau, including what we don't learn. You know, I mean, he's not, you know, we're in an age of the cancel culture where we're like, oh, he was some old uptight white guy, let's flush him down the toilet. Well, he had parts of him that aren't super appealing to me, temperamentally quite different than he is. But that doesn't mean I can't extend historical empathy and take the things that I can put to use in my life. And I'll just say, before we, you know, interact more, that for me, that's a huge part of my writing. I was very influenced by a college professor of mine, Walter Jackson Bate, who was a biographer of John Keats and Samuel Johnson. And he, Bate, like Johnson, loved biography above all other forms of literature. And he loved it because he felt we could put to use what we read there in our own lives, and we could affect our own lives. And that's been something I've kind of, you know, I don't know if that's really true or not. Maybe I would be just the way I am. But I feel like by communing with long-dead writers, I have taken some habits that aren't terrible and have learned some things. So that's a big aspect of the book, too, is kind of talking to the ghost of Thoreau. And so that's an overview.
It is.
But there, as you know, there are lots of nooks and crannies.
There are.
Too.
One thing that really fascinated me and that I wanted to ask you about was, as you wrote, did you know that you were going to be able to apply Thoreau to all these different aspects of your writing here?
I had an instinct that I would. And the decision to write the book came after fairly early on writing a piece for the magazine American Scholar, which is basically the first chapter about why Thoreau matters now.
Mm-hmm.
And once I did that and kind of did a bullet point of the basic Thoreauvian lessons, and I'll just, if I can find it, I'll just zip through a couple of those.
Good.
They're pretty well known, but it was funny to do a bullet point list of Thoreau, but mm-hmm. Simplicity. I say, let your affairs be as two or three, not 100 or 1,000. That's been a hard one for me to learn. I built, as I said, a writing shack, but in Thoreau's shack, he would fret over anything that complicated it. And he has a line in Walden, it is best to avoid the beginnings of evil. And he was talking about a doormat and his decision not to have a doormat.
Right.
So he really meant simple when he meant simple. This is what I love in terms of the economy chapter. The cost of a thing is the amount of what I would call life, which is required to be exchanged for it immediately or in the long run. The desire for more things has direct economic consequences. When you are working for the future, consider the cost you are paying.
Mm-hmm.
And then I mentioned, and I see I misquoted, either in the book or just to you, I have traveled a great deal in Concord. And then, of course, just I love nature partly because she is not man, but a retreat from him. So,
mm-hmm.
And then one of my very favorite Thoreau lines is, the life men praise and call successful is but one kind. This is a theme throughout the book.
Right.
Particularly with my writing, we have to learn to value what is valuable to us, not what the world tells us to value,
mm-hmm.
which sounds a little bit trite and obvious, but is a very hard lesson to learn, and I don't think I would have learned it without really years of banging my head against the wall and not publishing a book. And I write about how one of the most obvious and direct influences Thoreau had on me was I started keeping journals when I was 16, and I've got over 100 of them now, 40 some years later. And those journals, while I was not publishing books in the real world, a phrase that Thoreau would have turned on its head and said, the real world is the world of nature. But those journals were where I really developed my writing voice.
Right.
And I started to sound like myself. And the early books that were failures, I looked at as kind of nurse logs that the later books grew out of. So it was kind of the importance of failure, in a way, is another mm-hmm. Thoreauvian lesson.
One of your creative writing teachers from my alma mater, Colorado University, was Linda Hogan.
She sure was, yeah.
Yeah, we've interviewed her on this show. She's delightful.
She was so important in a way I totally didn't expect. I took a nature writing class with her.
Mm-hmm.
I have now been, since that class, I've been called a nature writer for
right.
30 years. Something I never thought I was, and I've only recently started to accept, because it seems, as I say in the book, maybe a nature writer isn't such a bad thing to be.
Right.
But really, in this day and age, but what it really grew out of an exercise of Linda's, where she said, go out and watch an animal and keep a journal and keep notes of an animal. And I chose a great blue heron. I did drawings of it and I watched it. And it changed the way I wrote. I mean, it's as simple as that. And a few years later, I wrote a book about ospreys. And that really came directly out of that one exercise that Linda taught in the class. And I've been teaching her work recently, too, in my classes.
Oh.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah, me too. And you also shared some stages with Craig Childs?
While I was promoting the book last summer, I ran into Craig and we did a kind of interview.
Up in Telluride,
I got to know him first at Orion's. Orion is a great nature magazine, and they had kind of a think tank for, quote, younger nature writers. In the past, they had gotten together Wendell Berry and Terry Tempest Williams and Barry Lopez and Gary Snyder. And I said in the book that they used to call it Barry, Gary, and Terry when they got together. But But this was for the younger generation, and everybody was under 45 except for me. And as I say in the book, I was let in by virtue of my immaturity.
There you go.
but that's where I first met Craig, and it turned out he could rise to my level of immaturity too, briefly.
I'm sure.
And we had fun together, and we had fun together this summer, and I'm a big admirer of his work. I love the way, I'm a faux Westerner, you know, I come out charging out there and write about it. I do not have his cred in terms of walking the land every day.
But you have introduced us to this place, your backyard, I guess I should say.
Yeah. It took 18 years. You know, it's a funny how writing works.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote my first book while I was in Boulder, and it was about Cape Cod and how much I loved Cape Cod. And then it wouldn't do for a Cape Cod nature writer to live in Boulder, so my wife and I moved back there. And while I was there, I turned around and wrote a book about how much I loved Boulder called Under the Devil's Thumb. I also wrote, at the same time, I also wrote a piece for High Country News. Mm-hmm. Called The Polygamists of Place.
I was reacting
to how, you know, Thoreau, Wendell Berry, writers like that, commit to one place and, air quotes, marry a place, and how I had a hard time with that, and I was, you know, I loved both the East and West, and that continued after I moved back to Cape Cod. I was there for 7 years, and I was offered a job in Wilmington, North Carolina, and my wife was pregnant, and it seemed like a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been in the South, where we never expected to be, for 18 years. And it took 18 years to really make my place here, which I've gradually gotten to know, the subject of a book, which is this book. Other than that, I've mostly written about the Northeast and the West.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, I'm still a polygamist, basically. A place, that is, not a
right.
Okay, it's legal.
That's legal, yes.
Okay.
Would you like to read something for us?
Sure. I have a part that's kind of a... Well, I'll read that first. Well, no, I already told you the first part.
Okay.
I've been reading this part about my daughter going to a protest. The book is broken up into months,
mm-hmm.
and this is June, which is called... The section is called Civil Disobedience, and... I'll read this, which kind of is a more external, less introspective part. And this is at a rally, George Floyd rally in downtown Wilmington, North Carolina, where I live. While the kids chanted and marched and listened to speeches, I lurked on the other side of the street. I felt like a Secret Service agent, though to others I might have looked like someone a Secret Service agent would be watching out for, long-haired, bearded, wearing a mask, eyes scanning the crowd. At one point, a character even more suspicious than me showed up, a scraggly, scowly-faced man who rode an ancient ram-horned 10-speed bike through the bank parking lot across the street from City Hall. The man paused on the bike and began to scream, "Shut the f*** up!" over and over at the kids. This was a rally of just high school kids, which I say earlier, my daughter was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I moved closer to him. And so did one of the cops stationed near the rally, who was not, incidentally, African-American. "You're going to mace me?" the man asked. "I got a f***ing gun." Luckily, he didn't. And after the cop approached and had talked to him for a while, he petulantly rode away. I backed off but stayed vigilant. Hadley, my daughter, made it safely through the afternoon, and the most anyone in her group suffered was some minor heat stroke from the blazing Carolina sun. Compared to those being shot with rubber bullets or knocked to the ground by cops, they suffered little. And compared to the victims, like George Floyd, who had spurred the protest, they suffered not at all. But there was a risk. There is always a risk. That is the math of any protest. What are we willing to give up to try and effect the change we want? Are we willing to sacrifice our private pleasures for the public good? Are we willing to interrupt our oh-so-precious lives? It is dangerous business leaving the woods behind. It is scary out on the streets. Of course, it is more complicated than that. In at least one case, the ideas that inspire those on the streets were born in the woods. I'll let Martin Luther King have the last word. I became convinced that non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. No other person has been more eloquent and passionate in getting this idea across than Henry David Thoreau. As a result of his writings and personal witness, we are the heirs of a legacy of creative protest. The teachings of Thoreau came alive in our civil rights movement. Indeed, they are more alive than ever before. Whether expressed in a sit-in at lunch counters, a freedom ride into Mississippi, a peaceful protest in Albany, Georgia, a bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, these are outgrowths of Thoreau's insistence that evil must be resisted and that no moral man can patiently adjust to injustice.
Yes.
I wouldn't say that's a typical section, but it's, you know, as I say, it kind of pulses back and forth between the political and the personal, culminating in a way with the election when my next-door neighbor, who's voting for a candidate that I was not voting for, behaved very differently than the national reaction in that he brought over a six-pack after the election night and wrote a note to the victor go the spoils. And so he, you know, he reached an olive branch out to me.
Great.
And I do find in my traveling around the United States that the division, or at least I maybe have to use the past tense here, but the divisions have been less vicious than they sometimes are in portrayed in the media. Like, I have friends who have different political views, and so that's, to me, encouraging. On the other hand, things are worse out there. There's no question about that.
I was thinking about that protest your daughter attended, so I'm glad that turned out okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's scary, right?
Very, very. And you were looking at it at a whole, in a whole different way as a parent, which adds a whole other layer there.
Right. And, of course, environmentally, one of the hardest things to do is to, you know, to breathe life back into the old cliche of we look at the environment for our children's children, which is completely true and completely vital. But, it's become just some kind of trope that we repeat. But to think ahead and to project ahead into the future and to imagine what we're doing now really has an impact is something that's so vital to reimagine and so hard to reimagine. It's so much easier to live for the present and where we are right now.
And you capture that, and we get to know Hadley pretty well. She's quite the girl.
Glad.
Yeah.
She might not like that, but I do.
That's okay. That's okay.
She just applied early decision to NYU last week. So
oh, really?
We'll see how that goes.
So what's the next book?
Well, while I was touring this summer, and I did a lot of live visiting bookstores. It was in the window between when we thought things were better before Delta reared its head.
Right.
So I drove all over the West and did readings all over the West. And while I was doing that, as anybody else who was out in the areas I was this summer, the whole world was on fire, and there was smoke everywhere, and everything was blurred. And I happened to be at Ken Slight's house at Pack Creek the night the flash flood came ripping through, a month after the fire had come ripping through.
Wow.
And I just started to feel like I was living in the future. Like I was, all these predictions we'd made were now here, and inspired by that, I guess, it's a darkly inspired by that, I drove out to Paradise, California, where the Dixie fire was threatening. And then, of course, when I came home, it was hurricane season.
Ugh.
So I'm writing something called A Traveler's Guide to the End of the World, which is me, you know, doing my usual adventures, but in these fraught places where climate change is here.
Right.
It's not something that's coming. It's here.
Right.
We're in it.
Very apocalyptic.
Yes. But jokes, too. There are jokes in there.
Oh, good. Well, I gotta have those. As you did with Thoreau in this next one, will you be using other authors?
Well, yes, but maybe a little less, just for taking a break from that. You know, I did that with Edward Abbey and Wallace Stegner and All the Wild That Remains a few years ago, and I don't want to become a one-trick pony. So with this one, I'm kind of taking a wider approach and going to a lot of different places. I just was down in New Orleans after the hurricane.
Oh.
I had written a book earlier about the BP oil spill, so I was returning and talking to a lot of my contacts there from the oil spill in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So yes and no, yes and no.
Do you think you'll go with Tory House again?
I will definitely go with Tory House again. I believe I mailed the contract yesterday.
Great.
and I'm really enjoying their editorial vision and the kind of freedom I have. And at this point, you know, this will be book 13,
mm-hmm.
and I kind of feel like I know what I'm doing. And I do find some frustration with New York publishers. I've had good experiences with them, too.
I
published with Simon & Schuster and Norton. But I do like to be able to, at this point, follow my own vision more than that of someone else.
We like Tory House Press here, too.
Yes. Yeah. Thoreau would have liked it, too.
I think so.
We don't have to entirely agree with past figures, and we can be critical of them, but it does not have to be black and white. If we have historical empathy and understand they lived in a different time, we can use our imagination to go back, see them as flawed, and yet see what they can offer. And I would also add that when the left gets too far left, it starts to sound a whole lot like the right.
It's true.
In terms of dogmatism.
Mm-hmm.
And Thoreau, among other things, liked to tweak people and mm-hmm. tease to a certain extent.
Yes.
And what he most liked to tease is certainty. Anybody who mm-hmm. said, this is the way it is, oddly, he also was like that. He said, this is the way it is.
Right.
But the way he would say it was about things you wouldn't expect in a kind of contradictory way. And I like that, too.
Right. Well, I'm glad to hear that your shelter is rebuilt and standing and you're using it.
It is, but there have been these king tides on the East Coast in the last couple of weeks where the water is so high. So it's taken a little bit of a bath, the shack, but it's still standing.
That's good. That's good. It's been through a lot. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that, and we look forward to the next book.
Thank you, and I really appreciate you having me, Tracy.
You bet. And that was David Gestner talking about his book, Quiet Desperation, Savage Delight, Sheltering with Thoreau in the Age of Crisis. This is Tracy Hales-Vass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington, New Mexico.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.